There's a few words that are kind of popular. Now, here's a biology word that's been around for a long time, mimicry, the idea of one creature kind of mimicking another creature for its, you know, survival. What do we have here, an owl butterfly? Can you see the mark on his wing that kind of makes it look like an owl's eye, which might keep the birds away so he can live a little bit longer? That's kind of an older idea in biology. Well, this whole area has been kind of stepped up a notch these days, and they've put the word bio on the front of it. And here's kind of a definition. If you would Google this, you'd have hundreds of thousands of hits on biomimicry, the discovery and application of designs found in nature. Nature is today where engineers, inventors are looking for solutions to problems, for new products, new devices. There's just an abundance of things in nature. And we're going to explore some for our first session here this morning. By the way, in a little while, you have to help me out with something. We have an activity. You're each going to need a feather. Could my helpers, could you guys kind of spread these feathers around right now? They got some packets of, they're just duck feathers. They've been painted different colors. But if you could just take one when it goes by, the color doesn't matter, and put it aside, and we'll do something with it in a little while. So this is kind of like reverse offering. When the feathers come, you can take one out for yourself. And just take that for a little bit later in our program. The feathers are coming by. Thanks for your help there, fellas. Well, what we're going to do is look at some of the examples that are kind of in the media these days, some old and some new, in this whole area of discovering designs in nature and then putting them to use. And there's lots of them. And I'm not sure how many I got. If you're taking notes, you can see what number we get up to. And these are small things and large things. And let's start here with something really small. Diatoms. Some of you know that word. These are little bits of life, kind of like a plant, kind of like an animal, kind of in between. And these little guys are everywhere. Now, they're about the size of a dust particle, so you don't see them. They float through the air. They live in the soil. They live in fresh water, salt water. There's lots of them. And they have all different shapes and sizes. Now, these diatoms, they live in glass houses. These are little silicon containers that they build. It's like their shell. And many different shapes and sizes of these diatoms. And with electron microscopes, you can get pictures of these, and some of them are really amazing as they're around. Ah, looks like we got one shaped like a star there. And there's a whole bunch of them in the lower right. In fact, these microscope people used to have contests to see how many of these things they can mount on a single glass slide. You don't want to sneeze when you're doing that. And they have some of these classic slides. They must have worked on these things for days, for weeks, to get them all in those beautiful designs and then kind of cover them up. And they're on this small scale of things you can't even see. Aren't there treasures in nature of beauty that we can see on all sides? Well, what can these things be good for? I'm talking about useful designs in nature. Here's a couple of more. Some of these diatoms, their shells, they look like a sieve or a strainer. They got lots of little openings in them. Other ones, like the one on the right, almost looks like a gear. You see the little teeth around the outside edge? Now, people have studied this and saw these pictures and thought, maybe we could make use of these things. Now, the other word we got on the screen here this morning is nanotechnology, and that's big up here in the Northwest. This is the whole area of making things that are really small, complicated things. Motors, valves, pumps, actually like mechanical things that are so small you can't even see them. These are useful in medicine and space and everywhere else. Well, when you're making these nanotechnology type devices, you need even smaller components. Sometimes you need like a screen, a diatom. Sometimes you need a small gear like in a motor, and here's another diatom that kind of takes that form. And they're starting to use these things as components in nanotechnology. Now, these are quite fragile, and so what they do is they take these diatoms and they actually coat them with metal. It's called sputtering to make them more permanent, and you have these little devices that are useful. Here they've been around all through history, all through nature, and in our day we're finding out this is just what we need for these tiny devices. Design in nature on a scale very small. I was thinking about this. I think, you know, God planned it there in the first place, and we finally find out what it's good for. Maybe there's like, you know, angels kind of watching, and they're saying, well, they finally figured out the diatoms, why God made those for us to use. And I'm sure most of the stuff in nature we haven't found, we haven't even thought of yet, but it's out there. So that's what we're doing for a while this morning, is looking at some of these designs on the large and small scale. I think it's encouraging to see what we're surrounded by, and it doesn't come by chance. By the way, there's some other words in this whole thing that I ought to make a connection with. Well, here's a whole bunch of words. At the bottom, I have this term worldview. You've heard of that before? A worldview, it's your set of beliefs, okay? And when we hook it with a creation worldview, it's everything there in the circle talking about the days of creation. They were literal. And the gospel in the middle and the age of the earth over on the left-hand side. Over on the right, I've got intelligent design. That's really what we're talking about for our first session this morning, ID, intelligent design. But you don't want to isolate that and put it by itself. It's part of this larger picture. I think with ID, you also want to talk about who that designer is. So that's kind of where it fits in. I like intelligent design. I like all of these examples that we're looking at this morning, and it's all put there by the Creator, and it's part of our creation worldview. We're going to look at some more examples, because we got a lot of them here this morning. So on to the next one. And I'm trying to think of some that we can relate to and some unusual. Lightning bugs. Now, I know you've got some out here. We're loaded with them back in Indiana in the summertime. And the kids go out and catch these things at night. What an interesting creature that is. You know, these fireflies. They kind of blink off and on. They communicate with each other. And there they go here and there. And you can catch them and then let them go again. How do those things work? How are fireflies able to make light? No batteries, no light bulbs, but they do it. It's quite complex when you think about it. As they've been studied, it's been found out that these fireflies, they actually make a couple of chemicals from the food that they're eating. I think they eat smaller bugs. And they have two complicated chemicals that they synthesize. In fact, they've come up with names for them. One chemical is called luciferin, and the other is called luciferase. And we don't need the formula. You could Google that if you want to see it. But they make that. And they keep those two chemicals separate in their body. And when they put them together, they call it cold light. It's a chemical light. And the light comes on. We're not exactly sure how they turn it off and on. They're a little bit beyond us. But that's what they do. And that's kind of curious and kind of interesting. And so we've been able to make those chemicals, you know, in the laboratory now. And you can buy them. So here I have one of these light sticks, like you can get at the stores. And it's a plastic tube, and there's two liquids in here, and they're kept separate. There's a little glass container, and you've got to break the glass and mix the chemicals. Here, let's see if we can turn the lights on this morning. You bend this thing and shake it up. They're getting some different colors of these things. A light stick. The kids know all about these. You know, they're kind of fun in parades and just running around at night. They're making some of these things that are really bright now. They're replacing flares if you have car trouble. And fishermen use these, backpacking, just kind of a nice portable light. Very handy. They're making these things in huge numbers. And where do they come up with this idea? By looking at fireflies. More design in nature that was there all the time. And there's, you know, technical articles that talk about this. That article at the bottom is way back from 11 years ago, but it was talking about how they came up with these chemicals to make this light stick. They're still working on some different colors, but there it is. What a handy little useful thing. Now, there's one trouble with these light sticks. They don't last very long. After about 2 or 3 hours, they dim out. The lightning bugs can go for a few weeks, so they're still more advanced than we are, but we're working on it. Here, we'll put a little nightlight here in case we need that. Design in nature. And we're looking at a few of these things. By the way, while we're looking at insects and bugs, let me show you another one. This little creature is called a fire beetle. And this even comes up this summer when we had some big fires down in California. When those firefighters are moving toward a fire in the forest to take it on, they have noticed that some of these beetles are moving right with them toward the fire. These beetles are just attracted to forest fires. And what they do is they lay their eggs on the blackened, when it's still hot, the burned wood. That's the way they are made to do. In fact, sometimes the wood is so hot it burns their legs off, but that's where they lay their eggs, and they do all right, and they hatch, and you get the next generation. Interesting bug that kind of flees toward a fire. The real name for these things, they call them melanophila, which means attracted to black, the kind of the blackened charcoal of wood. Well, now that's a curious thing. Any design there that we can look at? They have noticed that these fire beetles can sense fire miles away. And as they've looked at them closely, there's two things that really impresses them. One thing that these fire beetles have is their antenna can detect smoke particles on the order of parts per billion. Very sensitive chemistry. And then they also notice that these creatures have infrared detectors. That's a type of radiation that fire gives off, heat. And they can detect that from so far away, it's beyond any electronics we have. Well, this has, you know, kind of caught the interest of the Air Force, who's into, you know, detecting the heat from airplanes to protect them or to find them. And so they're studying fire beetles to try to duplicate the kind of infrared technology that they have. These creatures are very advanced fire beetles. What next? What's out there in nature that we haven't even found yet? And these things don't evolve. They don't slowly improve. They're just there, and they've been there since the creation. Designs in nature. Right now we're looking at the little things. We had the fireflies and these fire beetles. Let me show you something else that's kind of strange here. I'm not even sure I like this name here, a slime mold. But here it is. Now you might have seen this before. It can be an orange color, a yellow color. If you have some wood that's decaying, like in the woods, you often get this kind of thing. Now this as well is kind of halfway between plant and animal. It's, you know, that kind of in-between category, but here these things are. And they slowly grow, and what they actually do is they need food, and they kind of send out tendrils to see where there's food, and then they kind of grow where they can. This has caught the interest of people. And there was an interesting experiment that was done, and you can read about it in the literature. Let me just kind of show you what this is. This was done over in Japan. We got six overlapping pictures here, and each one of those little boards, each one of the sections is actually, it was a sheet of plywood, and they made a map of part of the coast of Japan. That's what that white line is. And you see the little kind of that greenish blob in the upper left-hand corner? That was a little bit of this slime mold that they put on the board. And then all those little white patches were little bits of food. I don't know if it was pieces of bread or what it was, that they kind of put different places as if around the country, and they put them where the major cities are. And I believe they started the slime mold in Tokyo. Okay, so here we got this stuff, and we got these little bits of food kind of spread out. So this probably does it in the dark, so they just, you know, let this thing run for a while. And you can see the time going by, 0 hours, 5 hours, 8 hours, and this thing started to grow. Again, I forget just what the scale was, if it was a 4x8 sheet of plywood or what, but this thing is spreading out, and it's looking for food. And it sends out these, again, these tendrils, and what they found out is that this thing kind of finds the minimum time, the minimum path. If one place takes too long, it pulls that tendril back and goes a different direction. And when you get down to the lower right-hand corner, there's the original piece of slime mold, and it's made all these connections to all these food sources or cities. And it's done all kinds of mathematics. It's minimized the time and the distance to do that. Well, Japan is thinking, maybe we could use these tracks that this material has come up with to help design communication systems to minimize the amount of wire we need, or railroad systems. They're using slime mold to figure out how to build these networks for entire countries. The next time I look at a piece of slime mold, you know, I'm going to have a little more respect for it. This stuff knows what's going on. Again, it's just the way this stuff is programmed, part of nature and design. Practical design in nature. Here, let me again just do a little aside here. There's scripture that's the basis of our whole creation movement. There's a verse in Job 12:8, speak to the earth and it will teach you. Now, you remember the book of Job, and Job faithfully stayed with the Lord. And this verse, I don't think I'm pulling out of context to think that verse could say that by speaking to the earth, I think that means studying the earth, looking it over, seeing what we can find, taking a science course. If you do that, you'll learn some stuff about creation and practical ideas. I think that this verse is sort of just an incentive to learn all we can about the world, again, for progress. God's put lots of secrets there for us to find. In fact, I believe that God has put countless ideas out there in nature, hundreds of them, thousands of them, just waiting for us to find them and come up with practical solutions to problems and benefits and new things. I mean, that's what creation is like. And we still haven't found most of them, and we're looking at a few of them this morning, but we're finding more every day. And I found this kind of an exciting application of study of science. It's a whole new way to look at science, looking at the treasures that are hidden there for us to find, to live by. It's part of the way the whole world is prepared for us. So there, that got a little bit preachy, but that's kind of the background that I'm working on. And so we're going to go on. Let's leave that slime mold behind. Let's go into the water. Okay, so now we got a creature with no name, and we got to figure out just what this is. It's not a squid. It lives on all the oceans, including the Pacific. It gets 2 or 3 feet long. What is it? Starts with a C. You got it? A cuttlefish. You got it. Yes. Interesting creature. Now, why would we put this on our list? Well, it fits. This creature is a master of camouflage. It can change color in less than a second. It has kind of like mirror-type objects in its skin that can reflect the surroundings. And it also has little sacs with pigments in them that it can change color. We're not sure exactly how it works, but it can modify its color on its surroundings. And it's just being much studied. Now, the picture in the upper left is a cuttlefish, and he's close to some, yes, kind of some black coral, so it changes that color just that quickly. I don't know about the bottom picture. I think he's just showing off, showing what he can do on a colorful day. But if it's under green seaweed, he turns green and purple or whatever, and on it goes. Camouflage, changing color in an instant. Now, who would be interested in that, of, you know, being able to hide? Well, the military, because we need to protect our guys and gals. And so there are studies going on, and I don't know what all the studies are because it's classified, but they're trying to duplicate what the cuttlefish can do with paint and with clothing to keep people almost invisible. And I just put a hat in there. I'm not sure what they're doing, and I don't know, but they're making progress with that. And again, there's an article from 11 years ago talking about this. The military studying the cuttlefish to come up with new ideas how to protect soldiers. You know, what next? And I'm glad that they're looking at that. Interesting creature. Got some other things that are in the water here. A lobster. Can there be any good there? I guess it can make a good meal. I don't know much about that living back in Indiana, but here they are. Well, all these creatures have things to teach us. In the case of the lobster, one thing of great interest is his optics, his eyesight. Lobsters don't have a lens like we have of our eye where you focus the light back in the retina to make it work. It's completely different. In fact, their eye is made up of a whole series of, they're like rectangular boxes. Here, I just to help myself think about it, I took a piece of paper and I was kind of making a box like this. And there's a whole lot of these. They're kind of small in the front of its eye. And the inside of the box has mirrors on it. At least it's silvered. So if light goes in this end, it ricochets from side to side off the box and comes out the other end. Instead of a lens, it kind of funnels light this way, multiple things like this, and then the light hits the retina so it can see. Well, that's kind of a curious, there's lots of variety of optics, but that's what the lobster has. Now, the experts in optics have been studying the lobster's eye, and they've realized this kind of geometry might be useful, not for looking at visible light, but for looking at X-rays. Now, especially astronomers, stars give off everything. They give off visible light, infrared, ultraviolet. They give off X-rays. And it's hard to focus X-rays. A glass lens doesn't work very well, and you're trying to focus it together so you can see a star. So they've thought, maybe we can make a rectangular box like this and silver the inside, and when X-rays go in, they very nicely glance off the sides, they come out the other end, and so that's what they're doing. In fact, there's such a device as this as part of space. They call it a lobster eye telescope, and it's kind of a big contraption. I can just see the little squares in that top black and white picture that kind of shows some of these little rectangles. Studying X-rays in space technology by copying the eye of a lobster. Again, you think, what next? What do we still have to find? But it goes on and on, and I find that very encouraging, the way nature's been all put together for us. X-ray telescopes using that kind of device. I got a lot of these things, and they're kind of fun. While we're in the water, let me hit another one here, a dolphin. Now, as we know, they're excellent swimmers, and they can communicate, and they're smart, as you can see in SeaWorld. But just a very obvious one, the way these things swim, you know, by whipping their fluke back and forth, and they can go so fast, and they can breach, they can jump right out of the water. Well, one guy who's into making products thought he would duplicate these things. So he's come up with what's called a monofin. Now, I think it'd be kind of awkward when you're sitting on the beach because you put both of your feet into this container here. But once you get into the water, you can swim with great ease. You kind of just whip your that thing back and forth like a dolphin does. And you can market this. You can see this is for sale on the internet. I think I'd like to get one of these things. And they've studied this thing, and they say that you can swim for hours with very little exertion, just waving back and forth. And they say you can easily go 8 miles an hour underwater. Now, an Olympic swimmer can go like maybe 5 miles an hour for a short stretch, but they can go that way forever. I don't know, maybe you could swim across the ocean with this thing. And so they got all these commercials going on, and here's this gal swimming around. That's kind of an obvious design in nature. It was there all the time. A monofin. Let's try that out sometime, see what we can do with it. We have the lobster. We have the dolphin. I'm still under the water here. Let me try this one. These are interesting stories that go with these things. Now, what a crazy looking fish this is. What do you mean design? This thing is comical. A box fish? Well, a few years ago, over in Detroit, these car makers were trying to think the next generation of cars that would be fuel efficient and small and compact. And to get a design idea, these guys and gals went to an aquarium facility. Now, this is a big aquarium, you know, with lots of stuff. And they wanted to watch the sharks to see how they go through the water, because they're really streamlined. They were going to make some drawings. And while they're there, one of the guys notices down in the corner of the aquarium, these box fish. And they were looking at them and pointing and laughing at those things. Well, look at those silly things. Then they watched them more closely. And these box fish were kind of moving around through coral that they had, and they had some currents in the water. They didn't bump into anything. They did very well. And they forgot the sharks and started drawing pictures of these things. Then they went back to the laboratory, and they made scale models of these and did wind tunnel experiments and found out at the speed of ocean currents and the way these things are moving around, they are streamlined. They do very well. So they went to work, and they're coming up with cars now that are kind of modeled on the box fish. I don't think I want to even drive in a car that small. But in Europe, there's lots of cars like that, and I think they're coming our way. A new car based on the shape of a box fish. They're very streamlined. These little cars, you know, get 90 miles per gallon and on they go, and they're kind of squared off, but at the speed of a fish in the water or a car on the road, they work just fine. It's almost like they're made for that. Things in the water. I guess we're done with the water. Let's get into the air as we're looking at these examples. So let me go with one from days gone by. Let's call this one Charo for short. This is one of these flying reptiles. In the creation movement, by the way, we strongly believe in a supernatural creation. Everything happened in six literal 24-hour days. You know, why not? Why complicate things? And we had the light on day one, a separation of waters on day two, plants on day three, just running through the creation week. Anyway, all the animal life shows up on day five and six. On days five, we have the creatures of the water and the creatures of the air, including this thing. And on day six, all the land animals. So I think this is creation week stuff, which means it's been around from the beginning, however old you think it is. Now, the current view in this whole area of biomimicry, they say, these creatures have slowly evolved over time, and the ones that somehow mutated and had some kind of beneficial design, they lived on, and the ones that weren't designed, you know, they just got cut out and they went away. That's the usual definition of how these designs come to be, that it just sort of gets weeded out, the ones that aren't designed. Well, now this creature, he's been around from the very beginning, even evolutionists would say, and it's designed. In fact, some of the best designs we find are in the fossil record. Anyway, this creature, they've only found one of these, and it's over in Eastern Europe. And it's kind of a crazy thing. I don't know if these drawings show very well, but it's got like four wings on both the front and the hind legs. And on the front, it has these little webs, as best we can see in the fossil. And that's kind of unusual. So they've done studies of this and realized that that's a great benefit, especially at slow flight, like when he's landing. And so when it comes to aircraft, they're designing some similar to that. I think this is actually a French plane. And they have the little wings on the front end. They call it a canard, and that helps it when it's landing. Now, I'm not sure if they saw the creature and then made the plane, but they've kind of come along together. That creature knew what it was doing. He had those little front wings. I don't think any animals have that today. Bats don't have that, flying squirrels. But this creature from the fossil record designed even with these little front wings, and it's just what modern airplanes need, design in nature. Let's see, we went from the water to the air, and I'm just kind of whipping by these. Let me show you another one in the air that's kind of curious. You have some of these around here. They live all around the world. And it's the funniest looking bird. Small body, big head, large beak. Looks like it's been designed by a committee. But there's something about this bird. He sits up on a branch above the water, and when a minnow or a frog goes by, straight down he goes and hits the water to get his lunch. And they've noticed when he does that, it makes hardly any splash. It just slips right into the water and starts swimming. It should be in the Olympics, you know, for the high dive, no splash. That's the way it is. Well, now the rest of this story, if you could just think with me back to Japan, where we have high-speed trains, bullet trains, they call them. They go 200 miles an hour. We don't have anything quite like that yet in the U.S. And these trains are very safe. They get the people around, but there's a problem. In Japan, there are lots of mountains. And so they have tunnels for these high-speed trains. And when a train goes through a tunnel, you can't slow them down. You got to stay on schedule. When they're going through the tunnel, a cushion of air builds up in front of the train, pushed along. And when the train exits the tunnel, this air rapidly expands. It's a sonic boom. It sounds like thunder. It's not a good thing. It rattles windows for miles around. It wakes people up. Japan has strict noise standards. Something needs to be done. One of the train designers was also into birds and got to thinking about this kingfisher that goes from air to water with hardly any splash, kind of like a streamlined change, somewhat similar to a train going from a tunnel to the air, a big pressure difference. So they've gone to work, and on these Japanese trains, they redesigned them so that their front end resembles the beak of a kingfisher bird. Designing trains based on a bird that God made way back on day number five, design in nature. In fact, I kind of got a kick out of this picture because this train, you see these little lights here? They were kind of mimicking the nostrils of the bird. They really copied this thing. They ought to give that bird royalties or something for doing that. By the way, while we're in the birds here, let's try a little project. Did those feathers get around? Just more design here on a Saturday morning to kind of keep us going. I'm just looking at the feather that you have here. They're all duck feathers. They've just been dyed different color. Pretty lightweight. You know, somehow birds make these things out of air and water, and there they are. But for our little experiment, if you could just take the feather and kind of hold it up like this, and we're checking out a design here. And can you kind of pull down on the side? And if you listen close, you can hear a little snap when you do that. In fact, do it a whole bunch of times. Mess up that feather. You can do it to both sides of it. Sometimes you see feathers laying outside like that, all disrupted. But that's only the first half of our activity. Next, can you put it back together again? By kind of pulling upward on the sides, you might have to do it multiple times, but you can get that thing to kind of zip back together again. And when you do that, you know, it's waterproof. Water would drip right off that. And then you can pull it apart. You can put it back together as many times as you want. If you look at a feather with a low-power microscope, what you'll see are there's all kinds of little hooks on there that grab each other. They're kind of springy. They attach, and then they unattach. In fact, this reminds us of something on a Saturday morning. like a fastener that kids have on their shoes and jackets. It starts with a V. No more hints. Velcro. Now, that was patented by an Englishman several decades ago, and he got rich on the idea, but he didn't really invent it. It's been around all the time. This is God's Velcro in a feather. It's that kind of hook mechanism that's been there since the creation week. Now, they also have these kind of things. They show up, you know, on cockle burrs. Do you have your program that we have this weekend? I don't know if you have yours or not, but on the cover, there's interesting graphics. And on the bottom of this picture, it shows a close-up. That's an electron microscope picture of a cockle burr showing all those little hooks. That's the very thing we're talking about right now. You have the same thing on a feather on both sides, and they grab each other. So that's the deal here. What a neat fastener that is. Of course, that helps these little cockle burrs to spread out their seeds, and this keeps the bird feather together. That's one of the classic examples of a design in nature, Velcro. And don't say that the birds invented it either. That was given to them back in the creation week, and there it is. You can keep that, by the way, for a bookmark, and it's kind of a neat little example of design in nature. Hey, we've got to keep moving along here. Got a few more before our break. Thinking about the plant world. Now, around the country, we have these beech trees, and they leaf out in the spring. And it's a very curious type tree. The whole leaf gets fully grown, and it's all folded up inside a seed pod. And then one day, the pod splits, and the whole leaf suddenly appears. You can kind of see the little lines in the leaf like it was folded up. And in fact, I was making a model of that just so I could understand that better, just make it out of paper. Here's the leaf all folded up in a seed pod, and then one day it splits. Come on, open up, and the whole leaf shows up. It's sort of like an accordion, the way they're folded up. It's design in nature. And we're always looking how we can make a buck on this and how we can make use of it. So what can we do with this folding mechanism? Can we apply this even to the space program? We have all these space probes, these satellites, and some of them need to have a solar panel up in space to collect sunlight, a solar collector. But you've got to get them up there folded up inside the space shuttle or whatever. And so they've thought this might be a good way to fold these up. And this has been used here and there. Here's a picture of the space station, and down in the lower corner, some of these panels, the way they were folded up with this mechanism and then put up there, and they spring open. Learning how to make space things by studying leaves off a tree, design in nature. And let's see, what else could they do with this thing? Most of you are into GPS to get around. Some of us are still using road maps, you know, like highway maps. Remember those things when you unfold them, you can never get them back together again? Well, there's one company that's making maps like this. You can pull it apart, you can put it back together. I need a map like that. Pretty neat idea. And what they're going to come up with next. Coming from Indiana, I had to mention corn, because we put out a lot of that stuff. Seed corn for eating or for our cattle. And we've learned things about corn. Now, this picture on the left shows a small corn shoot pulled right out of the ground. What we have found is on a sunny day in the spring, when this corn starts to grow, sunlight goes right down through the leaves, down through the stem, down into the roots, and lights up the roots. And if you could dig the soil out of the way, there's light down there. It's conducting light underground. That's how this thing gets energy, solar energy. And then along with the water and the nutrients in the soil, it helps the thing to grow. Now, there's the fancy word for that on the upper right there. It's fiber optics. I think several plants might do this when they grow. That almost, you know, that semi-transparent sprout, that stem can conduct light. Now, fiber optics, that's a big name these days. We're burying it all around the country. Maybe your email gets around on fiber optics somehow these days. But it's kind of neat stuff. And I brought some along here just to look at this stuff. Made out of plastic or maybe out of silicon dioxide. And somehow this stuff can conduct light, and it's very useful. It's actually replacing metal wires. Emmanuel, can you help me here a minute? We're going to try a little demonstration. Let's see, could you? You hold that end. And if you could just kind of stand over here. What I was going to try to do is shine some light in this end and see if we can get it to come out Emmanuel's end over here. It's fiber optics. So, it's all tangled up. What do you think? Can we get light to go through there? I'm going to use this laser beam. You already saw this. This thing kind of makes a green type light. And so, now, if this was a garden hose in your yard, could you shine a flashlight in one end and get it to come out the other end? try it. It won't work. But this is fiber optics. So, watch the end that Emmanuel's got. And let me just get this going here. Aren't you glad you came out on Saturday morning? Good work, Emmanuel. Look how long this thing is, and it's going through a knot and everything else. You know, if this light was spread clear across Washington, the light comes out the other end. If this is quality stuff, 100% of the light, there's internal reflection and all kinds of stuff going on, interesting material. So they're trying to build fiber optics, and they're trying to improve it. And what's one thing they're studying? Corn, which is God's fiber optics, which kind of shows us the way to go with all the optical things that are going on inside. Thanks a lot, Emmanuel, for your help. So there it is. Boy, it doesn't take much to impress us on Saturday morning. But it's fun stuff. It's kind of simple, but it's all great design ideas. Got a few more here as time's running down. Just like that flying reptile, I wanted to mention another old one because this is really challenging the idea that things have evolved and gotten better with time because dinosaurs show great design. Now, we think that these were all made on day 6, you know. That's when all the land animals, the cattle were made. This whole idea that they lived in a land before time, that needs to be challenged. But whatever the story is, here they are. And here's the one with a big club in its tail, you know, stay out of his way. Probably could knock a tree down. Even though these things are gone and they've been mineralized, you can dissect what's left of the tail and see what it was like. And it's amazing what they find. It was not a solid bone, but it was very complicated. It had all kinds of fibers going this way and that way. I had some kids make some stuff out of Play-Doh to see what it was like, you know, kind of roll it out like this. And this is what that bony structure of the ankylosaur looks like, multiple layers going every which way. Now, I was thinking about this picture. They make things like this that are very tough and strong. Bulletproof vests are made like this where they weave this material. And that's what this ankylosaur had, a very strong and lightweight tail. Among other things, this is kind of what fiberglass is like. Now, whoever invented fiberglass, I don't think they were looking at an ankylosaur, but he had it all the time. Designs in nature, even of older things. Well, I don't know if we're going too fast here, but we got to keep rolling. I got just a few more. How about our human body? Anything we can get out of there? Lots of good designs. Oh, looks like a rainy day. I think that maybe is a picture from Pennsylvania. A while back, there was a fellow, his name was Robert Kern. And this was back in the 1960s, and he was up in Detroit, and he was driving across town on a rainy day like this. And back then, a few decades ago, windshield wipers only had 2 speeds, on or off. And on a day where it's just a little bit moist, you know, the scrapers make a big noise and they don't work very well. And this was bothering him. And he thought, why can't we make a windshield wiper of a car like our eye so that it blinks, you know, when it's needed? And so he came up with the idea of an intermittent windshield wiper. And he says that he got that by thinking about the human eye and the way that our eye works. Now, we all take that for granted. We've all got those kind of windshield wipers and the little control on it, but that's where it comes from, just since the 1960s. We could go on and on with the eye. You know, you've got an umbrella, you've got windshield wiper, you've got windshield washer. What an amazing design that is, but we better go on here because there's another one from the human body. Look at this bone. In fact, I brought one along here today. This is an impressive bone. This is not a real one. It's plastic. But do you know what part of the body this is? It's the biggest bone that we have. It's your femur. It's right down in here. You got this ball and socket that fits into your hip. Yeah, this must have been someone rather robust, a big person for this one. Well, this is kind of awkward with this ball off to the side. Some people have said, that doesn't look like a design. I mean, that could break. Shouldn't that thing be straight up and down? And you can have, you know, problems with this, but it is strong. Well, 100 years ago, there was an architect. And he was trying to decide how to design a new building. He wanted to get some new ideas. And one day, he's visiting his doctor friend. And they were sitting in the office, and the doctor had a femur like this on the desk. And the architect picked it up, and he thought, well, that's an interesting kind of curve there. And there's a lot of mathematics in that curve as well. Architects are into math. And in his mind, he took this bone, and he turned it around like this and saw this kind of slope here. And he thought, maybe I could design some kind of structure that has a tapered base to it. By the way, this guy was living in Paris, 1880. and there was going to be a World's Fair, and there was a competition for buildings. His name was Gustav Eiffel. And so he went to work, and he did all the mathematics and came up with the plans, and they allowed him to build his building, and so he came up with the Eiffel Tower. Even all the steel in the tower, he kind of based it on the little ligaments and parts inside this bone here. He really copied it. And there the tower went up, and his architect competitors said, "What an ugly building." They said, "It's probably going to fall down under its own weight, all this bare metal." Well, here we are 100-plus years later. All the other buildings are gone. The Eiffel Tower still stands. It's a great tourist attraction. And in his record, he says he came up with this idea and based the mathematics on the femur in our human body. Designs in nature. Are you getting tired of these? They do go on and on. Let's see, do I have any more here? Just minutes remaining. Have you heard of this thing? It's a new form of carbon that's been found. Looks like a soccer ball, 60 carbon atoms. Now, these things are too small to see. They're even smaller than diatoms. But these things are turn out to be medical containers. I mean, they're so small, you could inhale those. You could take them in, and they could put a few molecules of useful drugs inside. And they're also thinking that they could use these buckyballs for miniature ball bearings in nanotechnology. In fact, that's where we started, diatoms, and almost finished there. I don't think they've done that yet, but here are these perfect spheres. They're all around us in nature, and we finally discovered those and started to use those. This was my last design here. I especially like these things that were never alive, like stars and buckyballs, because they don't mutate, they don't evolve, they've been here since creation. Some of these stars blink. They wink at you. We call them pulsars. They're spinning real fast, and they kind of like their light keeps changing. And they are so stable, they are rivaling atomic clocks. These stars are being used now for time standards. For computers, we have to really keep close track of time. Remember Scripture where it says stars are for days and years and signs and seasons? One part of that reference may be that these stars are a good way to keep precise track of time. A use for pulsars way out there in space. Hey, just a reminder in all this that there's a serious side to these designs, even though they're a lot of fun to look at. There's a verse over in Romans that says you can see the things of God by looking at nature, and it says if you miss those, you're without excuse. That's kind of serious business, and I appreciate the designs that we can see, and I think we need to use those and even maybe challenge people of the design that surrounds us. It all shows God's His glory, and then we can move on with the gospel as well. Yeah, you're without excuse when you miss these things. Well, as you can see, I kind of have been taken up with this whole design area, and we have a book on this topic that a colleague and I have put together, Discovery of Design. There's some on the table in the other room there, and we've collected about 100 of these ideas in this book, the thing from nature, and then the invention they've come up with. And we've also started a website there at the top. Take a look at it sometime. In fact, as you come across new designs, email them to me. You can do that through this website, because we're trying to get a whole reservoir of these designs from creation. I think it honors the Lord to look at that kind of thing.